people who are going to be helping me here. One is Joe Conway. He's sitting right over here. He's one of our, big developers for the project. And actually, our biggest code contributor, Jim Connolly, is sitting in the second row with the blue shirt there, right there. So I may defer to them if I get stuck on some obscure question. What I'd like to talk to you about for the next 3 hours, or however long they give me, is to go over everything that I can impart to you about improving and analyzing the performance of CodeSwift. Now, I'm going to tell you right off the top of the bat that I'm not going to tell you everything. I can't tell you everything because the whole science of performance is kind of an iterative exploration process. Any of you who've done performance tuning before, you know there's not a cookie-cutter way. You basically have a set of tools in front of you, and you analyze which tools you're going to use and how you're going to put them together. So what I wanted to tell you about today is to give you those tools, to show you all of the things that Postgres can do in terms of performance, and to give you a feeling of the capabilities that are there. Give you some understanding of what's happening inside Postgres, because to understand what happens inside helps you to understand how to tune it most appropriately. Basically, I'm going to talk about performance from a couple angles. First is to talk about the process, the idea of caching, meaning that the basic understanding of caching is that you take the information that you need most frequently, and you keep it closest to the CPU. And Postgres has many methods of caching, many places where we cache things, but the resources, of course, are limited on any computer, and I'm going to go over that. Second, I'm going to talk about internals. What happens inside of Postgres? How does it process a query? How does it analyze how to best execute the query? And finally, I'm going to talk about storage issues. Issues of how to optimize your storage, storage placement, methods of indexing, and so forth. So those are the three things that I'm going to talk about. In addition, because the performance tuning iterative process, I'd like to have some dialogue with the group. I'd like to set aside some time at the end of each section to answer questions from the audience. As interesting as I am, I often find that the audience questions are much more interesting than what I might say. So, we're looking forward to getting your questions about performance, or how come this happened, or why didn't it use my index, which is just the question that we get all the time. I'm looking forward to answering some of those questions. Specifically, a lot of times, the people who have questions, other people have the exact same questions. So it helps to spice up the presentation and also to give some hands-on aspects of performance tuning. Are there any questions so far? Just the introductory part. Let's talk about caching. This is a basic display of probably kind of funny, but okay. As long as they're colored, I guess. basic display of, let me get the panda fade out of the way. Of the hardware caching that happens in a computer, specifically a Unix computer. What you basically have is a CPU that has a fixed amount of registers. Usually that's the only storage you have inside the CPU, or 32 registers or 64 registers that hold maybe, bytes each of, 32 hints or 64 hint CPU storage. Outside of that CPU, you have cache that sits usually either on the CPU chip or next to it, 256K cache, 512K cache, 1A cache, 2MB cache. And these sit around the CPU, and they keep frequently requested information close. When the CPU needs to get something, it asks the cache first, if the cache has it, it sends it right away. If the cache doesn't have it, it's got to go out to typically out to memory or the kernel cache or some other place that has that information available, and then brings that from RAM over into the CPU cache, which then sends it to the main CPU, CPU processes it, and then so forth on its way back out. So, and then finally, for things that don't fit in this kernel cache or don't fit in the RAM, you've got disk drives that cache information. Typically, you think of it as swap, where things that just overflow the RAM and start shooting stuff out from the disk drive, and those hopefully are pieces of information that you're either not going to need anymore, or you're not going to need anymore for a long time. And then finally do need it, we're going to boot the process and move the disk on and go get the information and shoving it back in. So this is the idea of how the typical computer in general is set up and how it does the caching. This is just a basic idea of how caching is laid out in terms of sizes, CPU registers and measurement bytes, usually in kilobytes, sometimes in megabytes. The RAM is usually in megabytes, although now we're starting to see gigabyte machines of RAM. And this drive are usually gigabytes. I don't have a single terabyte of this drive usually, so at least at that level. Let me get specific to Postgres. How does Postgres implement its Snowpack? Well, it's basically, obviously, a three-tiered process. We have the disk drive or the disk blocks, which is by far this cache. It's also my biggest cache, of course. Okay? My disk drive and my blocks are the farthest cache away from my processor, basically. Above that, I have, and it's very hard to read, partially because of the way the colors are on this, as you can see it on your hand down there, are the kernel buffers. These kernel buffers, again, use, keep information that's been requested from the disk, it keeps it available for you, and you then have the ability to pull stuff, instead of going all the way to the disk, if it's in the kernel cache, you can pull it right out very quickly from there. There's an additional cache that's used in Postgres that you may or may not be familiar with, and that is what we call the, it's kind of very unclear, but the shared buffer cache for Postgres. Right? This is a cache that exists above the kernel cache. If we can think of how this process works, you've got the disk drive with these little spinning platters and arms and so forth. Very slow, the thing's got to turn all the way around so you get to the piece of information you want to see. That arm's got to go back and forth. Any kind of hardware motion, obviously very slow. Then you have the RAM, which is quick, okay? But Postgres can't manipulate RAM, you can't manipulate the kernel buffers directly. In other words, you've got Postgres kind of running here and it wants to modify some row or it wants to change something. It can't reach into the kernel buffer and change it. It's got to transfer that kernel buffer into its process address space, make the change, and then send it back to the kernel to then finally to the disk. So what we have here is something that's above the kernel disk cache that sits in the process address space that the Postgres backend can manipulate directly. Now you may wonder, well, how does that work? Because you've got multiple people changing stuff all at the same time and all this stuff. And what happens if we get a block from the kernel cache? Somebody else gets a block from the kernel cache. Well, notice it's called a shared buffer cache. What that means is that those Postgres buffers are shared by all of the Postgres backends that are running. Okay? And they are all looking at the same chunk of memory and all manipulating the same chunk of memory. So if you have 100 users all issuing SQL queries, all those queries are directly modifying that one shared buffer cache. There's a lot of advantages to that. Obviously, you still have to do locking and make sure two people don't try to modify the same buffer at the same time. okay? But all of a sudden, you've got that, those buffers really close to process. They're not sitting out in the kernel where you've got to copy it into the process and then back out again. They're sitting in that address space. Now, the way that we do that is something called System 5 Shared Memory. How many people are familiar with System 5 Shared Memory? Oh, cool. All right, great. System 5 Shared Memory basically allows us to allocate a chunk of memory that we're going to use, you know, forever for all of the backends together, and we all can manipulate this pool of data that's really close to where I am. Now, let's just, before I get into a bit more, there should be more in this slide, but there has been recent debate over how big that shared buffer cache should be. Okay? Particularly, how big should it be in comparison to the kernel buffer cache? Because if you have a machine that may have, you know, I don't know, 256 megabytes of memory, well, the bigger you make the shared buffer cache, the smaller the kernel buffer cache is, and vice versa. So, some few people have argued that they think that the Postgres buffer cache shouldn't be too big, because if it's too big, then the kernel buffer cache is too small, and you have, you know, performance problems. On the other hand, a lot of people have said that the Postgres pure buffer cache should be pretty big, and the reason is because the copying of the data from the kernel buffer cache to the Postgres shared buffer cache takes time. You're transferring data from the kernel into the shared buffer, that's a tag buffer, and if you do that enough, you know, you're basically sending a lot of information from one area of RAM to another area of RAM, back and forth, if it doesn't fit, you gotta move stuff back and forth, and that can obviously affect performance as well. So, the jury's still out. I'll get a little later into how to size that and how to make an optimal size and the types of experiments you can make to see how the size of that shared buffer can increase the performance. But that's a clear case we're trying to put that information close to the process as possible and not out in the disk drive or the in addition, you can see that in this case, we've got three Postgres backends. All of them are accessing the same shared memory. Okay? They're all pointing to the same area and all doing locking to make sure they don't hit each other, but they're all able to manipulate all that information. Are there any questions about that particular aspect? Okay. Yes?
Is the right-hand log in its own shared memory?
I'm getting there. Yeah, I'm just about to get there. Let's talk about right-hand log because it's the other side of the slide. Okay? Right-hand log is not, it's very related to performance, but it's not related as much to caching per se. Here's the issue that we had before we had a write-ahead log. How many people are familiar with the write-ahead log? Okay, you got a good number. Let me tell you what happened before we had a write-ahead log, and then I'll tell you what the write-ahead log is and what it does. Before we had the write-ahead log, you see the red area here, okay? Anytime you commit a transaction, we had to take that red area and make sure it got to the disk drive. The reason for that, because when you say commit transaction, or you run any query, a single query itself is implied to be in its own transaction. It's, you know, one update statement, an update, that's as though you're saying in, update, then, is that clear to people, that structure? That's pretty fundamental to the business itself overall. But, so when I speak of transaction, I'm just saying, you know, your transaction is committed. Where as soon as you commit a transaction, that red area has to go to the red area. Because if it doesn't, and the machine crashes right after you say commit, the data is not there. You don't have the data on the disk, the machine crashes, it comes back up. Where's my data? I say commit, where is it? Now some databases, are a little more forgiving or a little more sloppy about this. They'll say that, you have to have committed, and then the machine had to stay up for like 3 seconds, 5 seconds after that. And then it will guarantee it's on the disk. But if the machine crashed like right after you did the commit, then we're not going to guarantee that it's on the disk. And there are some performance reasons for doing that, but we, at Postgres don't think, we consider that sloppy. But when you say commit, you expect, as soon as you say commit, that's it, shut that machine down, and know that's going to come up, and that transaction is going to hear as we committed on this. So that's what we used to do before we had the right hit log. Was enforce all of those shared buffers with disk. And the way we did that is something called sync or fsync. And what fsync does is it allows you to, it forces those blocks to write the disk. It doesn't cache them, it caches them in shared memory, but typically what happens when you do a write in Unix, you write to a file, it sits in this kernel buffer for a while, and then when it gets enough, when it's a certain amount of time has elapsed, they'll then write it out to the disk drive. Usually in a pretty optimal way, or trickle it out, or whatever. So there was sort of a system where it would trickle the information and then write it out to the disk drive, maybe 30 seconds, 10 seconds, 20 seconds later. If you've ever noticed in Unix, if you create a file and it puts things like 100,000 lines in there, and you just turn the power off, it'll back up again. While we were looking at this, if it existed, it may be empty. Where only half your data would be there. This is Unix file semantics. Okay? For the database, we don't have that luxury. When somebody says, I want that information, that may have to encode this. So what we need to do is we need to take all that red area, and we've identified the buffers that have been buried by that transaction. In other words, which buffers have been modified by the transaction. And we would write those red buffers to the green area, which is the kernel, and then we force those blocks out to the brown area, which is the disk drive. Now, the problem was that if you modified 20 tables or 5 tables in your, or 5 pages, for example, in your transaction, we had to write all 5 of those pages before we say that transaction. And if those 5 blocks were different parts of the disk, it would, you know, go to the one spot and write it, and then go to the second block and write it, and go to the third block and write it, and the fourth block and the fifth block. And then it would come back and say, oh, I'm done. As you can imagine, all that moving around the disk and waiting for the file to spin, that takes time. So what we did was, we implemented, I think it was in 7.0, the write-ahead log. And what the write-ahead log does is it allows us to collect all of the changes that we've made to the database in one file. And when we commit a transaction now, we don't have to go all over the shared buffer cache looking for buried buffers and then writing those buried buffers all to the hard drive and then saying it's committed. What we've done now is anytime we make a change, we write a smaller record to the write-ahead log. And we do that as we make changes in the transaction. When we go to commit the transaction, instead of having 20 different blocks writing all over the place, we just write the write-ahead log. We just flush that write-ahead log to this. You can see the fsync red arrows that are forcing the information down to the disk drive. As soon as we write that, as soon as we know the write-ahead log is hit the disk drive, we can say it's committed. The reason we can do that is because the machine crashes right after that. When the machine comes back up, it looks at the write-ahead log. And it then replays things that were in the write-ahead log, and it modifies any of the disk blocks or shared buffers that may need to be modified to correct that, those changes. So those changes, it looks as though the red area was written to disk, even though it wasn't. We fix it basically on recovery when the system starts up. We look at the right log. Yes. So it's kind of a journal. Yes. It's kind of a journal. Yes. Yeah. And when we started using the right log, we didn't notice a significant decrease in performance. Because all of a sudden, we had collected all of our changes into one file instead of having them all over the place. And in fact, we're continuing to improve the way we log, continuing to improve performance, and the way that we sort of manipulate it. So we're continuing to use that rate of log for additional performance improvements while still guaranteeing 100% write of data that's committed and 100% recovery. Yes.
Is there some small period of time when it's been committed to the write of that log, but select wouldn't yet see what was committed?
Can you repeat the last part of that?
Okay, so data's been committed to the write of that log.
Yeah.
Select is done on the same row through some other process. Is there a race condition in there?
Okay. He's asking, is there a place where the write-ahead log would write the disk, but the shared buffer for some reason would not see the change, or the other backend would not see the change? Unfortunately, that never happens. The reason that never happens is really in the beauty of the shared buffer cache itself. Okay? All access by all backends, all data, universally in any table, is done through that shared buffer cache. So none of the backends can see things as somehow out of step with another query. Now, you asked specifically about the write-ahead log. The write-ahead log is basically a duplicate of the changes that have already been made in the shared buffer cache. So there's no sense that somehow the shared buffer cache would not agree with the write-ahead log. In fact, nobody really looks at the write-ahead log. In most cases, until it comes. In a lot of some cases, we'll be looking at it to do certain things, but in most cases, it's just we're just worried about recovery there. Now, it brings up an interesting point in relation to it, and that is that Postgres has a very tricky way of writing things and not allowing other backends to get confused by what I'm doing. And the reason the way we do that is with a transaction ID. In other words, we assign a transaction ID to whatever backend running has a certain transaction ID. And any change it makes to the data, it marks that change with its own transaction ID. So that all the other backends coming along looking at that row, they see the transaction ID, they know that transaction ID is not committed, they just keep going. So I can do anything with that run that I want. And nobody else can accidentally come and look at it and think, this is valid data. And it's part of the philosophy of the non-overwriting storage manager where we don't take a row and modify it in place, we create a new copy, we put a new transaction ID on it. And we manipulate that copy. And the old copy remains unchanged for other backends to read. This is one of the reasons that we have such good concurrency is that the old row and the new modified row both exist at the same time. Other selects can continue happening as I'm modifying this row and nobody has to wait for me to finish or anything like that. So it's just the beauty of the way the system works and we didn't design it this way. This is sort of how it came to us from Berkeley and we continue to enhance it and find other uses for this sort of nifty technology basically. Yes.
Is there one
lockup
per transaction? Is there
one lockup per transaction? Question. The answer is there's one write-ahead lockup for the entire installation. And the reason there's one is because we don't want to do fsync more than we have to. We want to localize those fsyncs as much as possible. So we have one write-ahead lockup with every user. When you're doing editing of that installation in any database, and it makes it very easy for us to localize it, and recovery will become very easy as well.
So if a number of people are doing an update at the same time, do they all have to wait until they're all done? And then they can estimate the difference.
Okay, fortunately, we do not have that problem. But the question is, if you're doing mobile updates, does everyone involved have to wait for all the updates complete before you write a disk? Well, they have to remember how updates work in Postgres. It takes a copy of it, puts its transaction ID on it, and starts modifying it. Now, If somebody else comes along to try to modify that same row, okay, that's one case where we have to block. In Postgres, the writers never block the readers, but the one writer can block another writer if they're modifying exactly the same row. I know this is a little beyond performance, but it does relate somewhat when you talk about locking. We'll get into that. So, in that case, the one who's, if both people are trying to modify the exact same row, we have to determine, is that transaction modifying that single row going to commit, or is it going to abort? So if it's going to commit, then we can then start. If it's going to abort, we can start. We have to find out which one's going to happen. So in that case, the one waiting to write that row is going to have to block. That one's going to finish, it's going to flush the right ahead log, and the second one can go, make another copy of the row, in case it's committed, make another copy of the row, and then for this timestamp, for this transaction, and then it writes to the right ahead log. So the right ahead log writing is serialized. You don't have intermixing of here's part of my row and part of your row and somehow in the log at the same time. You don't have to get a lock, right? And then finish. And then somebody else gets the lock and they write. The concurrency is actually very good. We don't seem to have a problem with it. I mean, I think Tom knows the concurrency tests on CO. Well, we have a bottleneck here. Including when we didn't really see, that much of a problem. We suspected there might be a problem, but I haven't seen it in past.
Okay. You're basically saying you're an implicit during read, on all of the reads, and you never have to explicitly say some isolation during read.
Okay. The question is, and I'll repeat the question so people can hear. The question is, do we have an implicit during read capability? The fact we don't have an implicit during read. What you get if somebody is modifying the row, and somebody else comes along to read the row, they get a snapshot of all valid rows before that transaction started. They do not get, a dirty read would be where you see a row that maybe is going to commit, maybe isn't going to commit, or you see part of the transaction and not the other part of the transaction. We do not do that. The only modes we have are recommitted and serializable. And last year when I talked about those two, we talked about recommitted and serializable and some of the issues involved there. But we do not have, in fact, we don't even, so even on the to-do list, there's one or two cases where we'd like to do a dirty read at hand, as far as RTEs or whatever, and we don't even have it. So when somebody reads a row, they will see a valid snapshot of exactly where that data was at the time that all the transactions had started. And that's an implied way to list this operator.
Tom, maybe before you ask it on Friday afternoon, we'll give you a talk quiz into exactly that area and a lot more detail. But I'm on Friday.
Yeah, and he's giving a great talk. I've seen the slides and they were exciting, I'll tell you. In fact, they were so exciting I didn't even talk about it on the phone. Because I was like, wow, that's really cool. You know, we didn't think of that. So yeah, that's a real valuable talk to see. I believe that's 3:15, Tom, is that right?
No, it's the last slot of the full time.
Well, we're going to pack it. That's what I would say. Let me see if I can push that. Yeah, he's exactly right. The concurrency will be... Oh, there we are. Is it 2:30? 2:30 is 3:15 on Friday. Okay. Are there any additional questions? Obviously, it's an exciting topic for everybody. So this slide talks about two things. It talks about the caching of data on the left-hand side, and then it talks to the right-hand log and how the right-hand log tries to maintain reliability of commits while increasing performance. That's really the major reason it's there. It has some other advantages, but primarily that's why we used it. Yes.
How exactly do you know when the write-ahead log
expired because the shared buffer cache has been fully flushed with it. There is something called a checkpoint, and I'll get into that. It's later on. But what the checkpoint does is it just sort of writes all of the dirty shared buffers, forces them to this, actually a sync call, which just forces it can be dirty buffer the entire kernel to this. And then we can then expire the write-ahead logs and start new ones. Okay? In fact, I'll talk about that a little later, but a lot of people sort of look at the write-ahead log and go, well, how do I know when there's going to be too big, or am I going to run out of this space, or, you know, there's this whole, like, what is it? Because certain, operating systems, certain databases have this sort of log that can keep growing and growing and growing and I think Oracle is the one that comes to mind where they have this a new segment, they run out, and then they've got these roll-forward segments, and they can run out, so you've got to do all this jury rigging to get the things to keep running, basically. We don't have that. The write-ahead log is as soon as you've got the checkpoint, you know that you don't need that write-ahead log anymore, because you've flushed everything through this, and therefore you can just start with the write-ahead log, you know, right away. So it's just kind of a nice sort of feature. It's sort of, this is a scratch pad for us. It's a scratch pad for that shared buffer. That's it. It's primarily what it is. In fact, there's one case that's kind of weird. The developers are always kind of weird, but, and we're trying to find a way to avoid it, but, there is a problem that the shared buffer cache, when it writes to disk, could write, when you write the shared buffer cache to disk, you could write part of the block to disk, part of that 8K block, and then the machine would die. So you'd have on disk an 8K block, half of which was new data, half of which was old data. This is what we call, you know, would be a partial write to the drive. Now, I realize the drives are not 8K in size, the block could be 512. Bytes in size, but even then you can partially write a 512 byte block unless you've got really fancy disk drives that can, you know, have sort of this battery back cache that can force the stuff to disk even if you didn't fit. But even then you can't guarantee all 8K would make it to disk. So what we do is the first time we modify an 8K block, we write it to the right, and we put that block in the right hand block. And the reason we do that is because on recovery, we want to make sure that we don't have any partial writes, partial page writes that might be sitting on disk. So on recovery, when we reread that log, not only are we redoing some of the changes we've made, but we're actually sort of recovering full 8K pages to make sure even that is stable. I know some databases don't go through that process. They just, if they have a partial page write, they just sort of throw it in and say, uh-oh, go to your backups. Go to your log or something. We cover that way. And someday we may offer that as an option if we find that this 8K, this pre-write page, pre-change page writes, are causing a significant problem. But of course at that point, we would have one problem. We would have something that had recovery and so forth. So, when my recovery actually I'll be talking about. I mean, the next release and future releases I will talk, I think, on Wednesday about that. I have a replication call coming on that I want to talk about on Thursday, which is on this hot sheet that nobody mentioned. It was not in the book. It's 10:45 on Thursday in the morning, and it's about replication. Okay. Why do you think that went here? I am looking through here. Because my machine is not working. Let's go, if you can. Okay, well, I'll reboot the machine. I wish I could keep that scan, but I can't.
She's probably fine. It's probably the
other. Sure it is. He's doing nothing. It's just dead. My cat fucking working. No, the lights are going on. Well, I don't know if it's big. Are you in there? Okay. Let me talk about size of some of these things. Basically, my philosophy on size in the shared buffer cache is that my idea of size of the shared buffer cache is that you should make the shared buffer cache as large as possible until you start depriving the kernel of enough memory to operate reliably. And how do you determine that? Well, the way I determine it is when the swap area starts to get used. When all of a sudden, all the things that that operating system wants to do cannot fit in the main memory anymore. Then you start to use an area called swap. It's on actually page 6 of this slide, so you have a book here. So when you start to use the swap area, then you basically, the kernel is basically telling you, I can't fit everything in my memory anymore. I gotta use this cache. It's farther away, that's slower, instead of using the main memory. So, what we recommend, and I think we kind of agree on this, is that you should probably start with a shared buffer cache that equals about 25% of your main memory. Okay? And obviously on a machine that's 256 megabytes, maybe that's, what is that, 25% would be, 64K, I guess, 64 megabytes. On a machine that's a gig, RAM, it would be 256 megabytes of shared memory. This is a start. Okay? Then you need to look at some of your operating system statistics. Particularly the page out and page in stats. Page out is not a tremendous problem, because page out just means you're getting something from the buffer cache or the kernel process space, and you've moved it out to swap. Now if you never use it again, then you can sort of say, well, it was data, but I really wasn't ever going to use it. So as long as it stays on swap and it doesn't come back, then that's not really a serious problem. What is a serious problem is when you push something out of swap and then you need it again. For example, let's suppose we have a process, and that process needs 100 megabytes to run. Now let's suppose you're running low memory, and the system says, oh, I'm going to have to take 20 of your megabytes, and I'm going to put it out of swap. Well, if that process never needs those 20 megabytes and it runs fine, then it's not a problem. As soon as it needs something from that 20 megabyte region, the process has to stop. The process has to go out to swap. It's got to get back 20 megabytes or whatever it needs and needs to bring it back into the main memory. And then the process can continue again. So any of you running computers that didn't have enough memory in them, and you're like, gee, why is it so sluggish? You know, I run it, takes, like, I'll have an application like Mozilla, for example, which tends to use a lot of memory. And then you run some other processes somewhere else. And you go back to Mozilla, and Mozilla's like, it takes, like, it's black, it takes forever to kind of get started again. That's because Mozilla's out of swap. It's been shoved out of the main memory. So, in looking at this, the question is, how much stuff are you putting out of the swap? How much you bring back in the swap? If you're trying to bring much stuff back into swap, odds are your shared buffer cache can be a kick, okay, or something on your machine is putting more memory than is, and is causing serious performance problems. As soon as you page in, it's a serious performance problem. You almost have to do anything to get that number down. If you do some post-shared buffer cache, fine. If you reduce some other processes that are running on the machine, fine. But page-ins are killers. Some operating systems will show you how to do page-ins, other operating systems won't. But you really have to look at that figure to determine, you know, where your best size is for your shirt. Okay. Now, in some cases, for dedicated machines that have a lot of RAM, you may go to use more. You may use 50% of your RAM for shirt level pressure, or even more, depending on how much stuff you have there. And how big your database is, and how much churning you're doing the database. You know, there's nothing like a database where all the main tables will fit in RAM. Then you're not going to make this guy over all those. So all the stuff is in RAM, there's no waiting for this guy to do almost any operation. Yeah, that's fantastic. And some of these bigger RAM machines can do that, but others can't. So that's sort of how you have to analyze that. Tom, you have any comment on that?
No.
Okay. I think Commodore came up with 25% as a star, you know, as a target where to look for it, and then you sort of size it out. There are cases where, for example, if you just use 25%, you'll get a certain performance. Sometimes you'll just take it up to 30, and all of a sudden it's really good. In other words, if you've got a big table, and it's, you know, let's say it's 30 megabytes large, and you've got 25 megabytes of shared cache, and you've only got, like, most of it in RAM. You can make it a little bigger and fit the whole table in RAM in the shared buffer cache. All of a sudden, your performance will go way up. So, it's a very nebulous thing. It's based on how big your tables are, how much the tables you use in typical workload, and how much other applications you're running on the machine. It gets really complicated. So, it is a sort of an iterative thing that you use as you go. Yes?
It's really just hard getting along the line. About main memory database, trying to make the Postgres almost main memory database.
Is
it too early to ask if you didn't ask any questions?
Okay, whether Postgres can be made into a main memory database.
Either beginning to try to pre-cache the table as much as possible, either making it virtually into a main memory database, if your goal is super high performance.
Okay, so the question is, Is there any sort of talk of making Postgres primarily a main memory database?
Using the shared memory cache.
Using the shared memory cache
as that means.
As that means, right. The issue I think I have there is the question of how it would really look different from an ordinary Postgres installation that just had a big shared buffer cache. I know there are certain databases that just use memory. They don't have a tendency to make a disk a lot. They're almost only memory databases, and they just disappear when you're done. Well, you could just turn off right ahead log, and you go, okay, because the machine crashes, then you don't expect the data to come back, I guess. We don't really understand how a Postgres installation would have a leaning towards a memory-only version would be any different, really, than the current version. I mean, there'd be some nice higher differences. We don't get that much comment from it. I think that just taking a Postgres source and just defining a huge shared buffer cache is virtually the same. You probably turn off fsync, which we'll see a little later. So you never force the write-ahead log out to the disk. You don't need that. It wouldn't be anything dramatically different, I think, about Postgres. Now we also, other people ask, can you make Postgres like run on a really small machine? You know, I mean, your embedded devices and stuff like that. And actually there is one or two projects, I think it's on gbworld.postgres.url.org that sort of work with embedded versions of Postgres and some of the things you can do to reduce memory usage even further. I'm not completely familiar with it. We don't get a lot of calls for it, but you know, it's always an interesting direction to go. Yes. Is the right-hand log a main file? Yeah, it just looks like an ordinary file. Yeah.
It's devnull. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Make the file with devnull.
Yeah, well.
F6 would be
bad. You can't do that because it will create new files as it goes. So, we have to add switch to just sort of turn off right-hand log completely. It's a little suicidal for a database you wouldn't want to develop from. But I can see some advantage to that. One more thing I wanted to mention, related to performance. And unfortunately I can't get every little thing. I mean, the presentation's already like 53 slides. I'm going to have trouble getting it all in. I don't have slides for every little tip that I'm giving. You know, I just couldn't. The thing would be hundreds of slides. Another interesting, so I'm basically using the slides as a way of showing you, illustrating a lot of the concepts that we've been talking about. Another thing is shared bar cache. Some operating systems lock system 5 shared memory, that is Postgres shared bar cache, into RAM. What that means is it will not force, it will never force the shared buffer cache into swap if it runs low on memory. As you can imagine, forcing shared buffer cache pages to swap is really, really bad because not only is one process using it, but all the Postgres backends are using that shared buffer cache. So you page one, meaning one page or 5 pages out, all of those backends need to access one of those pages. They all have to stop and bring it back in. Some operating systems by default will force system 5 shared memory into RAM, lock it into RAM. Other operating systems will page it out just like ordinary process memory. And some operating systems have a flag that you can set that will either allow it to be paged or lock it into shared memory. I know, for example, that FreeBSD has a sysctl call which will force the system 5 shared memory to be locked. By default, it's pageable. Linux, I don't think it has a flag for that. I think it pages system 5 shared memory just like everything else. So on those systems, it's particularly bad to do page out. So not only are you paging out something that might stop one process, you're paging out something that might stop a lot of processes and a lot of backends. And obviously in those cases, page outs and page ins are really serious problems. I wish I had more documentation on which operating systems allow which calls. One of my few items is to try and gather some of that information. Which operating systems do it, which ones don't, and which ones allow you to control it, so people have a better idea of what they're dealing with. That only came up in the past 6 months or so.
I think actually that was one of the situations where we recommend not making the shared buffer cache too big.
Oh yeah.
If you can't lock it in, you better keep it fairly small.
Oh yeah.
So that it won't be a target for getting swapped out.
That's right. Anytime, as I was saying, anytime you've got that shared, anytime an operating system is going to page out system 5 shared memory like any other memory, those systems, paging out is really bad. So you want to make sure it almost never happens. Problem, as Tom was pointing out, is that workloads are really dynamic. Like, you know, you might have 20 backends and all of a sudden 50 show up. Or you do a lot of big sorting, or you're doing all sorts of other processing on the system only sometimes. So you've got this sort of system loads going all over the place. On those systems, you're right, it's very hard to know how big is, you know, I never want to be paged out. How do I know that I'm never going to exceed my RAM and force this sort of performance problem to happen? It's a problem. It's a problem. What I'm not really clear of is when these operating systems think about paging out shared memory, do they realize how many processes have mapped out into their address space? In other words, do they use that as a weighting factor when they do their computation? Normally, pages that are paged out are the ones that haven't been accessed in X, you know, minutes or X seconds or whatever. It starts to get low in memory. Do those operating systems actually look and say, well, you know, this buffer cache hasn't been accessed in a couple seconds, but there's 20 processes that are sharing, so I should sort of weight that based on my guess that they don't, that they don't really know looking at a physical page in RAM how many processes have backed that into their address space. So they just throw it out not knowing, you know, looking at it as an ordinary page. The point was 20 processes don't access in the same at the same time. That is true. Although, yeah, this is
something has to give at some point. You've got to have any process to start, something will happen.
What I'd like it to do is to swap out one backend's data segment, okay, and then let all the other ones keep going. And that would be ideal. What happens in this case we're talking about is you page out some of that shared memory, and all of a sudden, all the backends are debilitated until that comes back. There is a sense that it's some type of bottleneck for more action than a typical process. Instead of stopping in one, you're stopping, you literally stop all of them, or all of them all pause, because they're all not running instead of just taking out one. So, it's, you know, it's 6-1, it's sort of a new concept we've dealt with to come up with a number for the shared buffer cache. You just have to look at that page number and try and make sure it's zero. Any other number but zero is usually, you know, cause for concern. Yeah.
Does that basically set up a lot more than what it's supposed to? Or is it not too long after the flag?
The problem is that, I mean, the question is, do we automatically lock things in shared memory if we can? And the answer is we don't. One of the reasons we don't is we do not assume we're running as root. Okay? Now we could say if we're running as root, then let's do it. The problem with FreeBSD is that it's a sysctl call. So it means it affects all system five shared memory machines. And we're not really in a position where we're willing, even running as, well, you can't run Postgres as root, so what am I even saying? We're not in a position where we even want to sort of apply that across the board. What would be nice if there was some per system five shared memory mapping that we could say, here we're going to map this, and we want this to be kept in shared memory, but I mean, in an obvious fault.
Oh, I believe on Solaris we do, there is, Solaris does have exactly that feature. Somebody sent it out not very long ago.
Yeah, that's right. I did put that in, I think. I'm confusing with another Solaris patch I'm waiting on, though. I can't remember what. Yeah, you've seen it in the code? Is it in our code now?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there's another Solaris patch that does some other, it does some other Solaris feature that I'm waiting for a guy, and he says he'll get it to me. That's a good point. Solaris has a per, you can do a per system five shared memory. It's not a root thing, I think. And we were able to use that on that object. I just need to point. Let's get to the final, portion of caching. And that is just to look at the system, at the caching parameters that are available to us. And I can't read that. I'm not anybody else. Can you read that? Terrible. Yeah, was on the manual here?
I don't know. It's pretty fuzzy.
I'll have a sort of play of it when I'm on a break, we have a break for a while. Let's look up here. Let me just see what you. There's no real thing here. That looks confusing to me. I'm not sure. Okay.
Yeah,
Not that. Hey, can you get that back there? Now my fucking blue? That's a little better, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cool. Give me a brightness here. Oh, I see. Oh, got it. Oh, my God. I've already got it. Let's look at some of these numbers here. First, this is the Postgres.com file, which you all probably should be familiar with. What's the first big thing to do is the shared buffer number. That number is by definition very low. I'll tell you that right now. The reason it's so low is because we don't really want to field questions from people whose backends have started up. to be honest with you. In fact, what is that? 4 megs in memory, roughly. Okay? Something like that.
What's that?
4.8?
Half a meg.
Half a meg?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Half a meg, yeah. Well, you can see we're very conservative. The reason for this is that a lot of machines don't have a lot of shared memory available as configured in the kernel. And this gets into a whole snake's nest that I really would like to avoid. And that is that every operating system has a different way, it seems, of modifying the maximum amount of shared memory you can configure. Let me explain why that is. The reason is because system file shared memory by the particle was always kind of a messy, kludgy kind of a setup. Nobody really likes it. It's got all these parameters in a kernel like shm max and shm all and shm min, and they're sort of these cryptic kernel parameters that control how much shared memory the kernel can access, how much the process can create, how small one can create, how large one can create, and these are all, in many cases, hardwired into the kernel. Now Linux has a FOC file that you can echo to, and actually modify it on the fly, which is really great. Of course, the downside is that the shared memory can be paged out, which is not so good. So basically, to start your kernel work, your shared buffer work, you basically have to struggle with your operating system to find out, to make it allow you to create the size shared memory that you want to create. Most operating systems out of the box will just not allow you to create a multi megabyte shared memory segment. Like, or maybe Solaris or what, I'm not really sure. But usually the minimum, the maximum number is fairly conservative, 4 megs, 8 megs, 16 megs. So we have a section in the Postgres manual which talks specifically operating by operating system. How do you modify that? How do you create the maximum amount of shared memory for that particular operating system? And it's excruciating reading, but, and we're always looking for more documentation on how to do that. But we basically have step-by-step directions on how to increase that. Once you've gotten into, and typically, you just want to increase it some astronomical amount. I remember when we used to install, a Formix on HPUX9, we would just set it to like 4 gigabytes. But we didn't have enough memory machine, but we just set it to the maximum. Because we said we just want to control it ourselves. In many cases, and I'm not quite sure, but you just want to set it some unbelievably astronomical number, recompile the kernel if required, and then move on from there. Some operating systems you don't want to do that because it adds page tables that you may not need and stuff like that. So in those cases, you may want to say, I want my shared memory to be 50 megs, so you have to go into your kernel and set it to be 50 megs. Recompile the kernel, and then set it to 50 megs, and then run with that for a while, and then you change it sometimes, you have to recompile the kernel again. It's just a mess. Not good for uptime, as we call it. But unfortunately, that's the hand we're dealt, in dealing with system five shared memory. So this number is dramatically small. I talked about how to do that, how to come to a size that we think is reasonable. The second number here is something related to something called a free space map. Now, the free space map is used by the 7.2 version of Vacuum. As you may know, in 7.2 we have two versions of Vacuum. We have Vacuum and Vacuum Full. Vacuum Full is the old version of Vacuum, where it locks the table, it removes all the rows it doesn't need, shrinks the file size, and then it unlocks the table. A lot of people have problems with that. I can imagine you could, nobody wants to have to take them off. So the new default Vacuum in 7.2 is a non-locking version. What that means is that instead of locking the table and shrinking the file and those types of things, it finds rows that are unused, areas available, and it records those areas of unused disk in something called free space map. And when somebody wants to increase the size of it, wants to add a new table, the first thing it does, it looks at the free space map and it says, are there any available slots in that table instead of adding a new row to the end of the table and making the file bigger? Are there any holes that I can fill in? The free space map will return and say, oh yeah, sure, you can go to page 12 of that table and you can add the free space map there. You can imagine it's a great feature. The problem is that free space map is only of a limited size. So if you decide that you're going to increase, if you decide you're going to like make all sorts of deletions from a table, it's possible to have so many open holes in the table that the free space map can't hold them all. When the free space map can't hold all of the open holes, then it's going to just use the holes that it finds. And after those are used up, it may increase the depth. There may be additional holes, but it doesn't know about them. Because those additional holes wouldn't fit the free space map. Now, if you go back in again, it'll find all the holes again. Okay? But sort of a, Tom used the word steady state. If you want to get to a point where your free space map can pretty much hold most of the free space that you have in the table. Does the free space map hold the page numbers? Is that what it holds?
Yeah, there's every entry in it is page number and the amount of space
available
on right. That page.
Great. It's Tom wrote the free space map and the new map is accepted. So he should know. What we have here is basically the number of relations that can be tracked in a free space map and the number of pages, I assume, that can be used or stored in a free space map.
Right, that's the number of individual pages.
Okay, so how many page numbers can I store in the free space map? In this case, our defaults are that we can track 100 relations by default, and we can store 10,000 page numbers for those 100 relations. Any vacuum that should generate more than information from more than 100 tables or more than 10,000 page numbers, we're just going to discard that information. Doesn't mean you can't get it later, it just means you can't track it for a back page to use that information. The idea is that in most cases, you're pretty much going to get in those entries, you're pretty much going to get most of the free spaces you're going to be using, and therefore if you don't get it this time, you'll get it next time. So there's not a sense that we have to get every single free spot in that. And in fact, I think there's some code in there that'll try and remember the pages with the most free space. So it'll sort of steer you to the place where there's like a little bit of space left, or, you know, we can live without that. We can do a vacuum full later, or we can get it the next time we vacuum. So the free space map is sort of a steady state free space tracker. And in our case, where the free space map may not be big enough for your installation, you just delete all of the use table and then you just go and add stuff again. You may find that the free space map just like overflowed and then it can't. You go to add and then you use free space, but it doesn't know about it, so that it ends up making the file bigger, even though there was free space. So that allows you to sort of control some of the free space numbers in the system, and we have on occasion recommend people have seen unbundled workloads that they may want to keep their numbers a little bit. Yes?
How much memory did
Well, it's inside that shared memory here. In fact, if you notice here, all of this area here is in System 5 shared memory. This right here is not. I've cut out some of the headings. When we look at Postgres.hub, it'll say shared memory up here, it'll say, you know, non-shared down here. So all three of all this stuff here is in shared memory.
Tom, I think the direct answer to this question is that the upstem pages thing multipliers basically 6 bytes. And I don't remember how big the integer relation is, but it's not huge.
Right.
A couple of those bytes probably.
Yes.
So if you're operating in a memory constrained environment and you have the luxury to be able to bring the database down to do a vacuum pull, there's no problem with actually just going down.
Right.
That's right. He's saying if you do a vacuum full, I'll just repeat, if you have very little memory, can you pull these numbers down and always do a vacuum full? And the answer is yes. Yeah.
Is there any reason, I think that might be taking a lot of time, but you couldn't use the empty rows as kind of a linked list of points to the next three?
I think it takes some hit in terms of more disk IO and less concurrency, but here at least.
He's basically asking, can you store the free space entries in the pages themselves versus having them shared memory? Of course you can, but as Tom pointed out, it ends up using disk space, so. And in fact, the other problem is that to read the pages have to be in shared memory, in a shared buffer cache anyway. So in fact, you kind of bring the page into the disk and get it in the shared buffer cache just to read the free space. And I think the idea was that we were better off getting it in a location that was always in RAM. That when, for example, if you stop your Postmaster and restart it, the free space map will end. Okay. In fact, that's sort of an issue as soon as we sort of have this amnesia about free space when we restart the machine, and the next vacuum has to be run to kind of populate that again. In fact, there might be some value in just doing some vacuums as it again is something related to automatic, which we're some people are looking at, this ability now that it's not locked to do it on or off peak hours, or maybe do it on startup to kind of get that cash loaded a little bit. Especially if you see a lot of requests for insert or updates to a particular table, we should say, oh, somebody's hitting that table lock, let's go gather some free space for that box the next time. That's sort of heuristic. In fact, I'm talking to Jan about it. Jan Beek and was on the phone, I think. And I think he was going to play that a little bit with some sort of auto vacuuming process that would do all smartness about. Maybe use the statistics collectors that we have, which I'll talk about in the admin talk this afternoon. A statistics collector with sort of some auto vacuuming concept. Okay, he's not perfect, but hopefully he'll put some lights on it and get his thing. The next parameter is max locks per transaction. There is a shared memory area that maintains the number of locks in a proc structure. And I believe if you exceed that, I'm not sure what happens. The reason it's in shared memory is because the locking itself is in shared memory. You know, to track who has what locks and so forth. So that's all in shared memory. So we had to set sort of maximum number of locks to hold for back then. Finally, we've got this wall buffers thing. This, I'm a little, what is that? Okay. What these are, system clock shared memory of wall write ahead log buffers that we're going to write to the write ahead log on nesting. So it basically allows us to keep track, without, instead of writing stuff to the disk all the time, we basically have these 8 shared memory buffers and we write to those and then we write those to disk. So it's just a mechanism that we use. 7.3, I'm hoping to improve a little bit of the write ahead log stuff that we'll look at a little down here and make it a little clearer about what's going on with the write ahead log. And part of the reason is that is because we introduced write ahead log, I think it was in 7.0, and then we fixed something about it in 7.1, and when we fix something about the way the write-in log grows, we didn't want to go back and reevaluate some of the parameters. Then Tom made some improvements between 7.1 or 7.2 about the way to recycle. That was 7.2.
Yeah, recycling.
Right, recycling 7.2. And again, we never went back and reevaluated how the recycling affects the parameters. So write-in log configurations can feel a little cleaner than what we did. But that's just typically, I don't think we ever increase that wall buffers. There's actually a server message that comes out if you're doing like a lot of IO. I'm sorry, yes.
Those buffers are shared buffers and
addition. They're in addition. If all this is shared memory, here's the shared block buffers, and then these are all additional shared memory usage of the system.
Why does the write in the block buffers be in shared memory? Aren't they a back end thing?
No. Write in log is shared by all backends. And they need to do that because we're only going to write one file for everybody. No matter how many people are using it, we've got one right in log.
But the buffers need to be shared between back end? Yeah, because everybody's sticking records.
Everybody's sticking records on the end of the
second file. The whole idea is to centralize the IO, so I guess just one. So each time something written in the right end log, that particular piece of the transaction goes into that buffer first, and then when that buffer fills, gets rid of the disk. Yeah, having buffers just gives a little flexibility. Right? So, okay. I don't believe there's any real reason.
Now we're out of the shared. This is the sort memory. Okay, this represents sorting memory used per backend. The way we sort large result sets is we basically take a chunk of the result set, we put it in RAM, we sort it, we write out the disk, we take another chunk of the table, we sort it, we write out the disk, We then finished with all the tables, then we had the disk files, and then we merged those disk files in to memory again, sort those sort of in ascending order, and eventually it was called tape sort, and eventually we end up with one big sorted result. So what this parameter allows you to do is to change how much memory is used per backend and per sort. And one query can do multiple sorts, so it gets kind of confusing. It's very hard to figure it out because you don't want too big, but at the same time, increasing it for very large result sets does significantly increase, particularly like report. If you can do all your sorting in memory versus having to write out these multiple disk files and then bring them back in again, it will increase report. That's a very hard figure set. I mean, usually you can take it up to 1 or 2 meg without problem. If you want to, you know, if you want to make it astronomical, you sort of have to know how many sorts am I going to be doing concurrently, yet, you know, not blow out my RAM and start having swap again. So, and that's also a trade-off between shared buffer, because obviously you make this bigger, this has to be smaller, and so forth. It's a confusing, concept. It really is. Yeah.
What's that feature?
512K. I'm actually, hopefully, one of the people suggested in an email that we put the units of measure in all of these, and I'm playing games with that. So hopefully for 7.3 we'll have units of measure, so we'll say, you know, 8K buffers or, you know, whatever, so you have an understanding of what you're manipulating. We recommend you read the manual that goes with this so you can really understand it. But at the same time, it's not aimed to have it. You have the units of this computer. Epsilon equals true. Epsilon controls, do we force the write ahead log to disk before we send it? The only reason you want to turn this off is if you want to get every last ounce of performance on your machine, and you had UPS on there, and you knew that your operating system was 100% reliable, and you, in some sense, were willing to accept the fact that if somebody came along and flipped the power switch after a commit, your database may not come back in a consistent state. Is that it? Yeah.
Or it's just report generation.
Or just report, well, report generation doesn't really do anything. So when you're generating reports, you're probably not doing any disk anyway, unless you're reporting by creating a lot of temp tables, right? But if you're loading a lot of data, and you don't care if you crash it, you have to start over again, start off. Yeah, you might get a nice performance boost out of it. So you're loading a big database, right, and nobody else is doing anything, and all the crash is going to be started, by turning it off, load it, it might it'll probably go faster. Yeah.
That's what they like,
it's complicated.
Yeah,
going back to the statement that you just made about temp,
yes,
temp tables that are being created, what kind of impact would that have on those temp tables on something that's basically a read-only database?
Well, temp tables are going to be epsync and written just like ordinary tables. So I realize it doesn't make a lot of sense because if the machine crashes, you don't really, those temp tables are useless anyway. But we do, and there has been some called block analyzing, having to temp tables. Right now, the block level doesn't really know when it's dealing with a temp table. So it really can't say, oh no, the temp table, let me not do a write-ahead log entry for this. I think there are a couple of cases where we actually use the write-ahead log for something other than coverage, so we sort of wouldn't want to bias that completely. But it would be an interesting optimization to just not do that for the temp table. And we don't really know how big the performance is to be versus other part of the code problems.
So if you write those temp tables to this on recovery, you just drop those?
Well, when the system comes back up and the back to the temp table won't even be there. It'll be gone. So if it comes back, what is it going to recover and then delete it, right? So,
well, I guess I'm going through the informing.
Yes.
Essentially, it writes those and comes back after the crash and says, oh yeah, how's the temp tables?
Yeah, we don't say anything in the news solution. At least we should. So, you know, if the tables come back, we don't recover.
two comments about that. One was, what Bruce was earlier mentioning, sorts. Sorts do not use temp tables, sort of, they just use temp files. It's not a normal control committee. The other thing is that there's an optimization in there for a table with only lives for the duration of a single transaction. Because it's got that local buffer. So.
That's right.
So if you set things up so you can create a table where you can read it before you can have it, then really
yeah, well that actually gets to a bigger point, and that is that the F-sync only happens in transactions commit. So if you have, if you create an ordinary table, and then you do something with it, and you delete it before you commit, then that doesn't get F-sync either. Well, I mean, it logs up different things.
Yeah, so I was suggesting, I don't believe the
one
for
manager goes long. It doesn't go all along. How would it come out?
We'll force stuff out.
Right. Okay, so we force it to the right log before we finish? The problem, I know we don't force the buffer itself. My assumption is we don't really track the write ahead log stuff, we just do it, right? And all those pre-write pages and all the mods, I think they probably log because...
Oh yeah, you're right, mods would be log.
Because we don't F-sync, when we commit the transaction, we don't F-sync those local buffers, do we?
Yeah,
we do. Oh, we do? We F-sync the local buffers. Okay. Alright, well, I didn't watch that. Okay. These are all related to the write ahead log. And I will tell you, they are, this is a snake pit right here, I'll tell you. Some of these, the ordering here is different than you'll find in the existing documentation, and one of my personal goals is to try and clean up some of this, particularly the first couple before 7th grade, so it's more easy to understand. All files here, controls how many extra files will create during a checkpoint so that
right, it doesn't have to create
ahead parameter. But the fact is that because our raw files are now recycled in 7.2 instead of being deleted, the whole concept of creating files during a checkpoint is a non-issue in virtually every case. So I believe that the new items here just remove that completely because it just doesn't have a lot of accessibility and it's kind of confusing because people think, oh, it's the first one, it must be really important. Well, in fact, it's not important at all. So this is just an artifact of some of the cleanup that we need to sort of do as we improve things. So in most cases, that parameter is not useful. The other parameters are fairly easy to understand. Wall sync method determines how that write ahead log is forced to disk. Certain operating systems are optimized for certain ways of writing to disk. F-sync is the default. There's something called F-data sync, which will sync the data but not the inodes for the write ahead log. If your system supports F-data sync, and it's better than F-sync. It's not just looks like F-sync. It's F-data sync, but actually runs as F-sync. Which you've seen, I think HQX has that problem.
Yeah, I think older versions have just subbed out F-data sync.
F-data sync is the same as F-sync. Basically just use, you know, F-sync. Now, I think we should probably default that data sync on the platforms that have it, and I think we actually do that.
Yeah,
so, it sets F-sync to default, but your operating system may internally not be using, your Postgres may internally be using that data sync in the past. There's also something called OSync OpenSync and OpenDataSync. What that does is it causes it to sync on every run, not on, it's not a set F-sync call. The advantage of that is if you're writing multiple blocks, it's best to just write them and then do the same. But if you're only writing one block, writing that log, then it's often better to just do the OSync. And therefore, it'll be written and flush disk at the same time, and then come back, and you don't have separate calls, just do it. Force that, and I think it's optimized, as I remember. Certain platforms are optimized. When you open the file with O_sync, it will force that stuff to disk easier than an datasync will. So, whatever operating system. So report that on. But this is something we all added in, and we probably should figure out, but we're kind of lost because it's still operating system dependent. Probably just let it better let it work. Well, debug obviously allows you to debug some of the stuff that's happening. Commit delay, commit siblings, probably not something you want to touch. What it was designed to do, and we haven't really fleshed it out yet, is when somebody is going to commit a transaction, if there's another backend that's about to also commit a transaction, it will be better off instead of me doing that data sync and the other guy doing the data sync, it would be maybe better just for wait for him to get to me. We can both just do one sync. And this commit delay and commit siblings attempts to control that and control attempts to sort of bunch up the commits so these all happen a little more synchronized. And it reduces the number of contacts and force data to this. We need more research in that area. And finally, checkpoint segments and checkpoint timeout. These control how often the checkpoint happens. And checkpoint happens when it basically stops writing to the log and forces, but it doesn't stop writing to the log. Basically sort of takes a snapshot of the log and creates a new file for new writes and then it forces the write-ahead log to disk and it forces all the dirty blocks in the buffer path to disk. And then you can get rid of the old write-ahead log file and start new ones. So it's sort of a clean out. The checkpoint sort of a clean out. If your checkpoint is happening too frequently, then you probably should increase checkpoint segments, which increases the number of write-ahead log files that you can use before you need to do a checkpoint. In fact, the bizarre part for me is that log files is pretty useless, and then down here is checkpoint segments. This is the one that means everything. This is the one that has all the value, not that one there. And the checkpoint timeout, I think this forces a checkpoint even if you haven't used checkpoint segments this often. So in other words, if you fill up three write-ahead log segments, it's going to force a checkpoint. And if you have, that happens really often, I think the checkpoint, log file are 16 megs a piece, I think. 16 megs. So if you fill up three of them, boom, it's going to force a checkpoint. And if you get your checkpoints too frequently, then you probably should increase that number right there. This checkpoint timeout merely just tries to clean out the write-ahead log every 5 minutes. Just, let's just make defaults. Check out. I think that's, it's something. Wait, is that what it is, Tom? Checkpoint timeout just forces
it. Yeah, even if you haven't used, even if you're not doing very much checkpoint every so often.
I'm a little confused why you'd want to do that, but is this like a fresh thing or
anything? If you're sitting there for 300 seconds without showing you three items.
Yeah, so why would we want...
I mean, because we need time to
do it. More like, why not? Yeah. You're going to have to do the IO eventually, so you might as well do it or not.
Oh, I see. So it's a more of a why not, let's just do it anyway. But we're not doing anything, so it's hard to imagine why we even save the IO. I guess maybe if we get busy later or something, I guess it's already done for us, maybe. I mean, I guess that's what... I know a lot of operating systems have this concept, so we carry it over to say, even though it's happening, just, you know, force it.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is that the a lot of databases have these really onerous checkpoints. Informix is a classic example. You know, when a checkpoint freezes. And in fact, there's this whole heuristic where if your checkpoints are happening and they're taking too long, you should do more checkpoints more frequently and it'll be shorter. We don't have that problem. Okay, nothing freezes really when you do a checkpoint. It just goes ahead and everything just keeps adding a new log and the old logs get fluffy. So we have that thing. We don't really, we aren't as desperately in trouble with that as we would be with others. That's as far as I want to go for the break. We have a break from 10:45, which means we'll turn to internals and storage.